Honorable Sifaku, as it was indicated, that is not well. And Honorable Koni.
I'm sorry.
And Honorable Smith, yes, I saw the letter, you are correct. Those are the five members that are not with us, with apologies. Then, without wasting time, we have a presentation from Mining and Environmental Community Network of South Africa, which I will give it over to them to take us through their presentation. Let me outline first how we'll be interacting together. We'll be giving you 30 minutes to do a presentation, and we would like to divide it into two. 15 will be your presentation, and then another 15 minutes will be for interacting. But if you feel strongly that you need more time for your presentation, you can do, but within the 30 minutes. And after that, members will interact with your presentation, and then thereafter, it's up to you to stay with us, or else you can recuse yourself if you have other business to attend to. But you are most welcome to be part of us. That will be the procedure of the meeting. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. My name is Matume. I am an attorney at the Center for Environmental Rights. I also coordinate for the Mining and Environmental Justice Communities Network of South Africa, which is acronymed MEGCON SA. I will be presenting with my colleague, who I'll just give him some time to introduce himself before I can proceed.
Morning, everyone. My name is Elton Tavayani. I'm from Sikukuni. I'm the deputy chair of MEGCON SA. Thank you.
Once again, I just wish to send my thanks to the Secretary of the Committee, the Honorable Chair, and Honorable Members for giving us this opportunity. MEGCON SA, as it may, is a network of mining-affected communities from across South Africa. And what we intend, what we are mandated to do is to protect and defend the rights of communities living near mining operations, communities that are affected by mining operations. And some of our objectives include engaging relevant stakeholders that include government at local, provincial, and national level. We also engage with industry, civil society organizations, and traditional authorities, as well as institutions created in terms of Chapter 9 of the Constitution of South Africa. We're here today to make these submissions on this Minerals and Petroleum Resource Development Bill, because one of the things that has been of great concern is that in recent times there has been a narrative that has been pushed. The gist of the narrative is that mining is done for the national interest. So because mining is done for the national interest, there is no one single community that can be able to make or break a decision on whether mining should happen, or when mining should happen, or how mining should happen. And we're making this presentation, these submissions, mostly to try to disrupt this narrative, because communities that live near mining operations, they're the ones that bear the brunt of the socio-economic, environmental, and other impact of mining operations. And this impact sometimes can include dewatering of aquifers, loss of land, loss of agricultural land that they used to use to grow crops or for grazing, also cracked houses as a result of blasting. We also know that mining has a potential of polluting the air, polluting water, and polluting soil. And it is communities that live near these mining operations that lose their livelihoods and also their enjoyment of a right to an environment that is not harmful to wealth, to health, or well-being, as it is guaranteed in the Constitution. We want to make the submission so that the MPRDA is amended in a way that communities living near these mining operations are able to defend their rights to a healthy environment, to culture, and to benefit from their own land. And the first point that we'd like to make in this regard is in relation to what we would like to term free, prior, and informed consent. It is abbreviated FPIC. At present, the MPRDA does not make provision for FPIC. What the MPRDA provides for is that the standard for a mining right to be granted is that a mining company must go and consult with the particular community, and then this consultation process, whatever consultation that has happened, will be submitted to government, and government will make a decision on whether or not a mining right is granted. We have found that this consultation process, in most cases, and our experiences have shown us this, that in most cases, these consultation processes are mere box-ticking exercises. So when members of communities make substantive submissions during these consultation processes, these are not taken into consideration, and they are not even reflected in the authorizing documents at the end of the day. And the submission that we would like to make is that if the MPRDA is to in any way promote equality, the MPRDA should incorporate the principle of free, prior, and informed consent. This should be the standard for mining rights to be granted. That means when the mine approaches a community for consultation, they should seek to obtain consent from that community before mining can happen. This will empower communities to have more bargaining power, and this will also try to alleviate some of the sufferings or some of the impacts that they endure as a result of mining. An example I'd like to make is that under colonialism and apartheid, when the vast majority of South Africans were not allowed to own land, this includes historically disadvantaged South Africans who are now entitled to own land, but now they're entitled to own land, but when they own land, they do not automatically own the minerals that are attached to the land. This is what the MPRDA say. So when mining companies apply for mining and prospecting rights on land occupied by historically disadvantaged South Africans, these historically disadvantaged South Africans do not have any real bargaining power, as opposed to during those times of owners who owned land and owned the minerals that lie beneath the real bargaining power in terms of when mining companies approach their land with a proposition to mine. They would use their ownership of the minerals, that consent, they would use that as a bargaining power to say they can either negotiate a good lease, they can negotiate royalties, and they could even negotiate shareholding in the mining companies. So our submission in this regard is that in order to truly transform the mining industry and promote equality, we submit that the MPRDA, it is crucial that the MPRDA include this principle of prior and informed consent. And then I just want to move on quickly to the second point, is the MPRDA, in this new bill, there is an amendment that suggests to remove from Section 2D, to remove the phrase including women and communities. This is within the objectives of the MPRDA, where it states that one of the objectives of the MPRDA is to substantially and meaningfully expand opportunities for historically disadvantaged persons, including women and communities. So what the bill suggests now is that it must remove including women and communities just to expand opportunities for historically disadvantaged persons. And with our submission is that it is not clear why the bill seeks to remove the emphasis on women and communities, because if anything, since the MPRDA has been passed, the conditions of women and communities have gotten worse, if anything, and that this emphasis should remain. I'm going to hand over to my colleague to make some submissions in relation to other aspects.
thank you. I'm going to quickly jump to the documents and notices as a point. If communities are to be properly engaged in participation and consultation, documents and notices will have to be more accessible. In mining communities, in some instances, we just wake up one day to find out that operation is already taking place. But the process within the MPRDA is very clear that it must start with the consultation process. In relation to the environmental authorizations and so forth. So what we are saying is that the notices must be placed within the public places like the hospitals, the shopping malls, the schools and so forth.
Can you raise your voice a little? They are struggling there. I can see them trying to pull their heads in front.
Yes. And sorry. Okay. Yeah, those notices, in some instances you find that the notices are being placed at our Mahoshis, which is traditional authorities. And then you find that some activists like ourselves, we are no longer in good terms with our traditional authorities. So it's very difficult for us to know what and when is participation is going to be taking place. Once licenses and authorizations have been awarded, copies of those documents must be made public and must be provided to affected communities. It is essential that communities have access to environmental authorizations, environmental management, and must be provided to affected communities. The disclosure of environmental authorizations and licenses, plans, and permits to communities enables communities to know their rights and assist the DMR in monitoring the compliance with those authorizations. This is the interest of both the DMR and the communities who are affected by mining. We are running out of time. So, Madume, this is to do with the social labor plan, I think.
No. Sorry, with our last few minutes, maybe let me just quickly address a few things. So while the Act as it stands right now, it identifies the creation of opportunities and sharing of benefits of the national minerals, and then the primary mechanism that the Act proposes for this is through taxation, social and labor plan, beneficiation. Taxation and beneficiation, they produce very few direct benefits for communities affected by mining. And social and labor plan, and these social and labor plans, which are not always complied with, they also confer limited benefits on communities. And it is always problematic, and sometimes when the plans are not complied with, there is no enforcement mechanism. One of the submissions that we would like to make in this regard is to include provisions within the MPRDA that would enable communities to be able to monitor compliance with social and labor plans so that they can be able to see whether the mine is complying with the social and labor plan and be able to report. We also submit that this will be both in the interest of the DMR as well as the communities. And then also another issue I'd like to address is what the bill fails to address is this problematic interaction between the MPRDA and the Restitution of Land Rights Act. It is submitted that this must be rectified because there's a significant number of land claims that are unresolved and mining licenses are being issued on these unresolved land claims. And then what happens is that once the community, maybe if the community is successful in their land claim, now they end up having a land claim on a piece of land that has a mining right on it, and then they did not participate in the process of that mining right getting obtained. And then lastly, this is a point that we didn't include in our written submissions, but it's something that we have been discussing with some of our colleagues from civil society. It relates to two views. I think the LRC has been making this point, and the Center for Environmental Rights also made this point last week, that there is a possibility that this bill, as it is, because it was referred back by the president on procedural and substantive issues, and then that the National Assembly could be confined to dealing with specifically with those issues that the president referred to, and not that the bill is opened up broadly to be dealt with. That is the position that was my colleague from the Center for Environmental Rights presented last week. And then I think when the DMR responded, said that by implication, because the president sent the bill back for public participation, by implication, that means the bill now has been opened up to be dealt with broadly. So therefore, there is no confinement. I just want to make submission that as Metcon SA, we favor the position that was submitted by our colleagues from the Center for Environmental Rights and from the Legal Resources Center for two reasons. One, I think there is no explicit provision in the rules or in the Constitution that allows the bill to be opened up. And then two, rejecting the bill and sending it back and starting the whole process afresh provides us with a unique opportunity. What has happened is that we have been deliberating this bill since 2013. And in 2013, we made submissions, and in those submissions, one of the problems that we had with the bill was that there was no broad consultation when the bill was introduced. People were not given an opportunity to decide what needs to be in this bill. And then we made submissions in 2013, and then when the bill came out as it is now, the submissions that we made in 2013 are not reflected in the bill as is. None of those submissions were reflected. So which means that the public participation process that we went to in 2013 was not really as meaningful as we would have hoped. And if the bill is rejected and we start the process afresh, then we have a new opportunity to do this bill, do a consultative process throughout the entire bill until we get to where we were today. And that will give us a bill that is truly representative of what the South African mining industry needs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now I would allow time to honorable members to interact with the presentation. There's one hand, honorable Labuskagni, and after that will be honorable Nyambi.
Thank you, Chair. I just need some clarity questions. The three prior and informed consent. I just want to know, do you have, as a organization, have an idea of the success rate of, or how many communities has been successfully included or incorporated in discussions and agreements around the issues that you raise here? And then on the land claims and mining rights as an organization, I have the following information that I requested via written question, that within the Department of Rural Development and Land Claims, there are 155 claims against mines lodged, 103 is still being dealt with, and 42 have been finalized. Now, out of those 42 that's been finalized, as an organization representing these communities, do you have any information and feedback on what the settlement or the impact of the finalization is on these communities? Because you say licenses with a significant number of land claims remain unresolved. Mining licenses are issued without regard for the contested nature of land ownership and without adequate constitution or interested and affected communities and claimants. So as a normal person, this implies that if there's a land claim, that's 103 that's still not unresolved, ownership of the land, the title deed, will determine who will hold the license. Am I right? So do you know of these 42 that's been settled, are there communities who holds the title deed, in the meantime, but doesn't have the permit right? Because I just want clarity. Is that the issue you're driving, or am I misunderstanding the issue? Thank you.
You're noting the questions, and then when they are finished asking, then you'll respond to all.
Thanks, Chair. My question is, let me start by welcoming the presentation. My question is in relation to something that was not said to us that you think it's important, given the time that was allocated to you. Do you have anything that you think will assist us when doing the deliberations that will make us to be able to understand something that was not presented today? The second part is a comment, Chair. My understanding of the process is to do exactly what was done by Honorable Labuskagne, that we are dealing with only clarity seeking question. If we are comfortable with the presentation, we don't waste much time on a presentation. So that is why I wanted just to remind ourselves that we are dealing with clarity seeking question, and she has done that quite correct. But it's for them to be afforded an opportunity to add anything that they think might assist us to come to a particular conclusion whenever we're doing the deliberations. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Over to you, Kedet.
Thank you, members, for those questions. Okay. In dealing with the question of FPIC, I believe the question was, as an organization, do we have an idea of the success rate of communities being included in agreements with mining companies? And our experience, and this is the one thing that brings us here today, is that always, in most cases, these agreements are always done between mining companies and facilitated by government to the exclusion of the affected communities. And then in cases where communities are sort of included is when they are included through traditional leadership representation, and then in most cases you find out that the traditional leader does not represent the interest of the entire community, and the benefits are only limited to the traditional leadership house and family. And then in relation to the question on land claims and mining rights, and I think we are specifically bringing this because we were briefed by some of our members from the Northern Cape in Hondekloofby, who are contesting for a land claim on a piece of land that De Beers had mining rights on, and then the mining right was being transferred while they're busy contesting the land claim. And then the problem that they have with the transfer was that they are not participating in that whole process. They're being excluded from that whole process on a piece of land that they could eventually own, and then they cannot determine the destiny of the land that they're going to have to own and use in future. And then, respect of Honorable Nyambi's question on if there's something else that we need to add. I think I just need to emphasize the impact of mining on, I think this is something that is not considerably taking, it's not taking into consideration the impacts of mining on people living next to these mining operations, because these impacts are not only environmental impacts. When a mine is moving into your community, that means there's going to be people who are going to be coming there looking for work, so there are going to be social impacts, and then there are going to be economic impacts. You're going to the limited services that you used to have. If you had a small clinic there, that means the clinic that used to serve 2,000 people now has to serve 4,000 people. These are the impacts that mining has on communities living near them, and that is why the voices of these communities should be brought to the fore. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm hoping that the members have been clarified. Come again? Okay, you want to add? Yes.
Thank
you.
You
are allowed.
Thank you, Chair. In relation to the land and the claim issue, where I come from in Sikukune, most of the land claims were lodged after realizing that there are minerals attached to the land. And because normally what happens is that the mining companies tend to devise those who may be against and in favor of those who are with them when it comes to the operations. And then they create squabbles. And then you find that the traditional authorities or the traditional councils are not constituted in accordance with the Framework Act. That results into the delay when it comes to the land claims, because the department will find out that the traditional council is not properly constituted in accordance to the Act. That's the reason why most of the land claims were not successful or were not concluded as yet. And then secondly, with regard to all the additions, as per Mr. Nyambi's request, is that the social labor plans, the social labor plans are the mandatory requirements for acquiring the mining licenses. And then we find out that the process of drawing the plans does not include us as communities, or the Act itself does not force the companies to include us. And the Department of Mineral Resources relies on the companies' annual reports for monitoring. They actually don't do the groundwork monitoring. You know, that is one thing that I find it very, very important. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That then concludes the time that was allocated for you, and I'm hoping that at least you did fair in terms of your engagement. Thank you very much for the presentation. We'll then go to our next, which is the Kukune Combined Mining. Sorry, I'm jumping you. That's your chance.
Madam Chair, I've been asked by Malanskul to thank you for the opportunity of making this presentation. I think it's clear that there's no way we're going to deal with 96 pages of submissions in the time period available.
Definitely.
What I propose to do, therefore, with respect in the way that you propose that it should be, I would like to ask the committee members, firstly, if there are any questions. I'd rather speak to them on issues that they want to hear about than the issues that we want to think is what they want to hear about. So if there are, obviously there will be questions later as well, but if there are any questions at this stage, I'd like to deal with those first if possible.
Our procedure is that you first summarize
yes.
your presentation,
okay.
and then based on that they then ask questions of clarity and any other thing that they have picked up in your submission.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the presentation and the work that was done, and you can see it was a substantial amount of work, is not really directed against policy issues and, let's call it, political issues. The aim of this was to bring about a clear, implementable set of legislation. And most of what is in this, these 96 pages, is aimed exactly at that, that it is not something which we trying to, with exception, there are one or two exceptions, that we are trying to change the way in which the government is trying to format their or regulate the mining industry, but rather at that it should be clear and that it should be implementable, practically implementable. That was the aim of this document. And I think if you work through it, you'll also see that it focuses to a large extent on drafting issues rather than any other issues. And for that reason, I've already approached the Secretary and said, is there any opportunity that we can engage with the Department with issues which I don't think is directly of a policy issue, which I would expect this committee to mainly deal with. I've been, and I've spoken now to Mrs. Kassam, and we will direct any further issues to her as well. She said that she's read through it all, and we're very happy to hear that. So what I'm going to do is to deal only as far as what I can with the more important issues. They are listed in paragraph 10 of the presentation on page 4, and again, we're not even going to get through those 14 issues, but I'll try and arrange them in the order which we believe they should be dealt with or are of importance. The first and probably the most controversial issue is the proposal to amend the definition of this act. That is at paragraph 58 on page 45 of the document. The aim of that amendment is to include in the definition of this act the codes of conduct that was developed under section 100 and the mining charter. And Parliament was referred to the problem identified by the President. It's one of the issues that were referred back to Parliament. And I take you to the President's statement on page 2 in paragraph 5, and I'm going to read it. The amended legislation elevated the codes of good practice for the South African mining industry, the housing and living condition standards for the minerals industry, and the amended broad-based economic charter for South African to the status of national legislation. However, in terms of section 74 of the amended act, the minister was given the power to amend or appeal these instruments, and when the need arose, effectively bypass the constitutionally mandated procedures for the amendment of legislation. Parliament decided that's incorrect and didn't, well, that's what I'm informed. We submit that that decision by Parliament is incorrect. Not only did the minister, the President, but also the courts already indicated that when it comes to legislation, Parliament is the body that is supposed to enact legislation, not the executive, and to amend legislation. Parliament is supposed to amend legislation. The Constitution provides that, and it's not for the executive to do that. I submit that if one looks at the nature of those two codes of conduct and the charter, you just have to read it to see that that's not legislation. It's not the way legislation is written. To try and enforce it as legislation is in open-ended language. It is written in a way which different words are used for the same concept. It's written as an aspiration or a policy document. And to try and enforce it by way of criminal procedure or by way of taking away mining authorizations is going to lead to disputes, obviously going to lead to disputes because of the open-endedness thereof. And I'm not saying this to you as a view. You've just got to look at the first charter that was ever written and read it. It says, stakeholders to achieve the aims of the charter through specific targets set out in this charter or the targets set out by the companies themselves. So it was never intended to be a piece of legislation. That's the way it's written. It's written as a guideline as to how rights should be granted. But it's not intended to be a piece of legislation that's enforced like parliamentary legislation is being done. And for that reason, we believe that I don't know whether the president will now, seeing that parliament has not accepted his proposal in this regard, is going to refer it to the Constitutional Court, or whether it's going to be enacted in this form, but I can assure you, it will be challenged. And is Parliament going to run this risk again to be told by the Constitutional Court that they're not fully fulfilling their statutory obligations? Because this is, to use a phrase that is misused so often nowadays, it's actually the executive trying to capture Parliament, because it is making legislation, which is the duty of Parliament to do. And I'm not so sure why. After the President has pointed out this problem, after the courts have why Parliament is so keen to give up its constitutional right to make legislation. We don't say that there shouldn't be a charter. That's not the argument. The argument is the charter has its place as a policy document. It's not legislation. But this is an attempt to make it legislation. And it is trying to usurp the powers of Parliament. And I'm almost convinced that the Constitutional Court is not going to allow that to happen. It hasn't in the past, and it's not going to do it this time either. So that's really the only, let's call it, policy issue that that we have highlighted. The other issues are a mixture of what is intended and drafting issues. We noticed that there's an attempt to replace Section 9, which used to be the first-come, first-serve procedure in the MPRDA, to replace that with invitation by the minister to submit applications. And then that is carried through to the application process for all the different rights, the prospecting right, the mining right, the mining permit, etc., to say subject to Section 9, you can make an application for a prospecting right or a mining right. Firstly, it's confusing because what is really the intention? We are now no longer going to have the first-come, first-served basis. We're going to have an invitation, and then we're going to get 10, 15, 20 applications. Are we then going to evaluate them based on which are the best application? But the Act already determined the factors that needs to be taken into consideration for granting or not. Now, it's possible that different application may have different merits, and that is maybe the idea that is being proposed in this amendment. But that didn't take out the provision still in those sections, Section 16, Section 23, which provides when it comes to the regional manager to accept an application. You can only accept one. And once he's accepted one, he may not accept any other until that one is concluded. Now, these two things clash with one another. If you're going to select it on the basis of which is the best, then you must surely look at all of them at the same time. Now, the process is still as it was in the Act, that you, the regional manager can accept the first one, then he can't accept any others, and the acceptance is the process that kicks on the procedure of evaluating. In other words, that informs the applicant that you must go and consult with people, etc., etc. Now, do we want all 20 applicants to go and consult? Or are we still following the process that's written into Section 9 and 16? And at the moment, that's a problem, the way it has been written. It's not clear what really the intention is. If it is the intention to evaluate one application against the other, then say so, and then that be the position. But then you must go and amend Section 19 and Section 23 and all the other sections that still entrenches a first-come, first-serve type of procedure. Then there's the amendment of the definition of historically disadvantaged person. That's the definition in used to be in the MPRDA. The charter started using the words historically disadvantaged South African because that's the words used in Section 100, not the same as in their definition. Now it's the intention to change the definition to historically disadvantaged South African and not historically disadvantaged person. So it appears that the legislature's intention would be to limit the interaction and the, because it's mainly to do with the compliance with the charter and consultation processes, is to try and limit that to South African citizens. But it still includes references to categories of persons and a community which don't have South African citizenship. So already in the definition itself there's a clash, because they can't be South African citizens. They maybe consist of South African citizens, but there may be in a community also people who are not South African citizens. As Parliament thought about the people who work on mines, many, many, many of them are not South African citizens. They live in Mozambique, they live in Lesotho. Are they going to be excluded now from the benefits that's provided for in the MPRDA to workers in ESOPs? Must they be excluded from the ESOP? Those answers are not questioned, but if you want to apply this literally as it's written, it means yes. You can't include in your ESOP citizens which are from the other surrounding countries. Also now, it has been excluded from that definition, corporate entities. Obviously, they can't have citizenship, so that's maybe the reason why they're excluded. But if we look at realistically, mining rights are held by companies, not by individuals. So in order now to see whether the benefits is being flow through to historically disadvantaged South Africans, you're going to have to use some sort of complicated flow-through principle, because the company itself can no longer be evaluated as a historically disadvantaged person like the previous legislation used to allow. And just as a drafting issue, there are several places in the Act where the concept historically disadvantaged person is used. So there was no process. You change the definition, but you don't change the other references in the Act. And I've put that in the notes, the specific references, so it can be followed up. We have a, let's call it historical problem. Whilst in the common law system that existed before 2004, the mineral that is mined belonged to the person who held the right to that mineral, and it was the common law mineral right. So if a miner mines, the most common example is platinum. Nature didn't separate these things very nicely underground. It mixed them up. So in the same rock, you get platinum and you get chrome. You can't mine the platinum without also taking out the chrome. In the old regime, that was dealt with by way of private rights. I mean, you sold your right to platinum, and whoever held the right to chrome became the owner of the chrome, and the person who got the right to platinum became the owner of the platinum. That process, that procedure, that principle was not taken up into the NPRDA, and this is an attempt to rectify that, and it should be done. The Minerals Act made a provision and said that if you have to mine mineral A and you can't help, if it's of necessity, you've got to mine mineral B, then you have the right to also sell mineral B, provided that you have to pay compensation to the holder of mineral B. This is a slightly different attempt in the sense that although the mining company that mines platinum and then is not the holder of the right, because the only right they have granted by the department is a platinum mining right. But now it receives chrome because it has to. It has no option. Then this is an attempt. Now, the person needs to declare the other mineral. It doesn't say how. So if he has to go and stand on top of the mining dump and shout, "I've discovered chrome," whether that's a sufficient declaration, we don't know. There's nothing about it being prescribed as to how it needs to be declared, but I think the Act needs to be supplemented by saying, say, by notice, written notice to the minister or something to that effect. And then the problem that exists is, what about the mining that took place before the declaration or the amendment of the right to include the, let's call it, subsidiary mineral or the byproduct? But you've already been mining for a year. Now, who owns that chrome? And I believe that it should be amended, the provision, so that it also provides that once your right is amended, it is deemed that you've mined the chrome lawfully since your mining commenced. I see that there is a provision to say that if you don't declare your mining of this byproduct, it can now be allocated to third parties. It's not practically possible. How can you now give the third party the right to mine chrome when the chrome and the platinum occurs in the same piece of rock? You can't have two people mining for the same. It would be chaos. So that provision we recommend should be deleted. I'm sorry, Ms. I'm not keeping track of time.
I'm keeping your time.
Okay, thank you. I then get to something which is probably also a bit of a policy matter, and that is beneficiation. We've been backing and toing and froing since 2004 about beneficiation. And with respect, nothing has happened about beneficiation. I don't even know whether there has been any progress made with regard to local beneficiation at all. But our submissions is this is not going to make it happen. It's all left over again to the minister to classify almost or declare some specified, I think is the word they use, strategic minerals. And then there's a whole process of trying to provide that the mineral must, if this designated mineral must then not be sold or cannot be freely sold to anybody, it must first be sold at what is called a mine gate price, which is impossible to understand or identify. And it's a very, very, very important concept. If you look at the words mine gate price, price is something that is determined by way of a contract or an agreement. But if you look at the way it is intended to be implemented, that was clearly not the intention. So how the mine gate process...
My apologies to disturb you. Can you be closer to the mic for the purpose of recording?
Yes, I will. The mine gate price is not something that can be determined. It's clear that that's not the intention, that it be determined by way of an agreement. So how do you determine it? There are no guidelines whatsoever in the Act, and there are also no guidelines or provision for prescription for it to be determined. So we believe that this is going to take us, again, no further towards really promoting beneficiation. And yes, as a matter of policy, probably. One always asks the question, why is beneficiation being promoted through mining and not through the Department of Trade and Industry? Because that's where that miners are not good at making watches. They're not good at making jewelry. And that's the process we're trying to encourage. Not let's let miners keep their eyes on the health and safety of their employees and the process of extracting the minerals to the best advantage of the country, and don't try and get them to promote something which falls outside of the area of expertise. As a matter of policy, I'm saying, it's not a drafting issue. The next amendment that I wish to draw attention to is the amendment of Section 11, which is the section aimed at providing ministerial consent when a right is being transferred. That's at paragraph 24. I'm just saying that for my own reference so I can follow it. Paragraph 34. In this submission, we made the point, and Mrs. Kassam has already indicated to me that she differs from me on that argument, is that if you look at what was Section 11 in 2004, Parliament legislated that it should be amended by the 2008 Amendment Act, but the President decided not to implement that amendment. But the new amendment is now based on the amended wording by the 2008 Act. Now that creates a conundrum. How does the person out there who reads this see, okay, you want to amend this section, but it doesn't read the way the operating law isn't the way, the section doesn't read the way the operating law is right now. So my question is, and I can understand, Mrs. Kassan said to me, yeah, but that is on the statute book, the way it has been amended. The fact that the President hasn't put it into operation means that that's his decision. But then my question back is, then shouldn't we be amending the 2008 Amending Act and not the 2004 Act? Because the 2008 Amending Act is the one where this amendment was legislated for. The 2004 Act, which you are amending, doesn't read like the legislature, this Amendment Act, proposes it to read. So I know it's a conundrum and it's a difficult issue, but I would propose rather amend the 2008 Act, which is on the statute book, I agree, than the 2004 that doesn't read like the Amendment Act says it reads. There's also a deletion from, and it's again a drafting issue, from words. If you read it now, it just makes, to some extent, no grammatical sense. There's an attempt to delete the words or any interest at a certain place. And it doesn't make sense if it's deleted, but whoever is the drafting person can read that and see what the problem is.
We are left with 6 minutes for questions.
I'm happy to answer the further issues. Stop pause. Yeah, I think I'll quickly deal with this.
I was not saying stop, but I was just indicating you can continue if you so wish. Yeah.
If I may just deal with one issue which is outside there, a big issue for the mining, well, for some people in the mining industry, and that are resident stockpiles. The courts thought they will come and interfere with the way things were obviously intended, and decided that mining dumps that were created before 2004 when the Act comes into operation is not dealt with under the MPRDA. The department decided in the end not to appeal that judgment, and it stands, and it's now been confirmed by several courts since then. The department's proposed amendments in this regard, I deal with in paragraph 46, is the attempt to bring those stockpiles into the regime of the MPRDA. And we don't have a problem with that. That's a policy. But if the way in which it was intended to be done is with respect, it's problematic in the way in which it's been done, because it wasn't done with the full understanding of the ownership issue. Firstly, there's a distinction between dumps which have acceded to the land and become part of the land, which now is dealt with under the MPRDA, regardless as to whether they were created before 1994, because they're part of the land, and if you want to mine minerals in land, you need a mining right. So the MPRDA deals with that aspect. So firstly, the intervention should only be limited to movable dumps, dumps that are there but are capable of ownership separate from the land. That doesn't come through clearly. And then there's the new concept of historic residue stockpiles. Now, although a residue stockpile is something that is created in terms of the MPRDA, this definition makes it wider. It's something that could have been created before the MPRDA became a problem. But then they're trying to transpose that into what is called a residue deposit, which is something which is created only after a MPRDA right has expired. Now, that cannot be before 2004, because the Act didn't exist before 2004. So we submit that must be looked at again and the definition amended so that it deals with movable stockpiles, let's call them mine dumps, that were created before 2004. That's our principal submission in that regard. Yes. Then I'll see whether there are any questions.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, your time is up. Mm. I indicated that you have 30 minutes. The only thing left is 2 minutes. If a person is asking your question, you won't be able to respond to that question. So I'm in that predicament. So it means your time is up. Mm. Thank you very much, sir. Can I then go to the next presenter, which is the Kukune Combined Mining Affected Community? Remember, you've got 30 minutes. Time is up. We did indicate to everyone that we've got 30 minutes for both questions and answers, but if a person decides to have all the time for the presentation, because it is a public hearing, it's for them to present to us. But if there's time left, you can interact with the presenter.
Chairperson,
thank you.
May I address this? Yes, yes. I fully understand that there's a time limit on this, and the reason for the time limit we can discuss in the committee afterwards, because there's reasons for that. I can't see why we have a presentation before this committee who have to take the responsibility and say whether we amend or not, and we can't ask clarity questions. Then it totally defies the purpose, because we can all read. I can read this document. If I can't ask questions on clarity, then there's no, this was a wasted 30 minutes, with all due respect to the presentation. Because if I can't ask questions, I still don't have the answers.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Honorable Lapuskafni. I've noted your consent. Let's go then to the next presenter.
Chairperson, can I ask you, if we're going to do this for the rest of the presentations, we can just call this public hearing to a halt, because it won't benefit any of the members of Parliament sitting here if these people come and do a presentation. I've got a whole file of presentations that we all can read if I can't ask questions on clarity. We can't proceed like this, because then we waste our time and we waste their time.
Thanks, ma'am. Honorable Nyambi.
Chair, without creating a problem, maybe to be fair to the process, an unintended consequence was created by not being explained, maybe to the presenter, that the 30 minutes is both presentation and questions. So I don't think it will do us any harm to allow the process of the clarity-seeking question to engage the presenter before they can leave, so that we do it justice to the process.
Thanks, Chair. Chair of Chairs, I did indicate the time left to the presenter to show him that he's running out of time for questions. But it wouldn't do any harm to give them at least 5 minutes to do that.
Madam Chair, if I can also make some suggestions to assist. At the top of the presentation, there's an email address. I'm prepared to answer email questions. Over and above, I'm not saying we shouldn't be asking questions now, but if there are questions which members wish to direct to me by way of email, I'll try my best to answer them.
5 minutes allocated, Honorable Labuskagne.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for the proposal for emails. We'll make use of that. I just want to go back to the mining rights, the paragraph 58. On the codes and the mining charter, according to, you've got a detailed outline here. According to the new development that the mining charter, a new mining charter has been adopted and been announced in this week, how does this influence your opinion in this paper?
Apart from making the amendment that's proposed in the amendment bill irrelevant, in the sense that it still refers, the name there is the amended mining charter of, which is the 2010 charter, and that's now been replaced. But I assume the draftsperson will realize that and put the new name, which is now the broad-based Black Economic Empowerment Charter, no longer the broad-based socioeconomic charter. But that's a different argument. I'm not here to argue about Charter 3, unless the committee specifically wants me to do that. That's, as we've seen in the newspapers, a controversial subject at the moment. And this act is aimed at making that document and previous amendment, further amendments, part of the legislation, and we're saying that's unconstitutional. It's this Parliament's duty to make laws, not the Minister's duty.
Thank you very much for the response. Any other question from the member? Honorable Nyambi.
It's one question. The MPRDA is in front of us because it was referred back, so we've dealt with it in the past. When we're introducing ourselves, we're very clear that we're coming from different provinces, so we understand the essence of it. From your side, maybe, what is it that is positive that is in the MPRDA? Anything that is significant that you think is positive out of the MPRDA?
I've addressed many issues in here. We've said we welcome these amendments. We may not say that the wording is correct, and we've tried to address those aspects where the wording is an issue, but there are several issues in this where we've stated in this memorandum that the attempt to amend it to rectify issues is welcome. So there are several of those issues. One of them is beneficiation. Another one is the attempt to deal with a lack of mine dumps that were created before 1994. All of those things should be done. Our arguments are aimed at saying, let's do it properly. Let's make it understandable. Let's make it implementable. Does that answer the question?
Thank you.
No. I can page through it and find the places where we say it is welcomed.
Thank you very much. Then we'll go to the next present.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, National Council of Provinces and the members. My name is Gilbert Muela. I'm from Skukune in Limpopo. I'm also the chairperson of Skukune Combined Mining Affected Communities. Skukune Combined Mining Affected Communities is a non-profit community-based organization for communities and members whose environment and human rights are affected directly or indirectly by mining and mining-related activities. We are conducting our work on environmental activism, mining community mobilization, capacity building within the region of Skukune in the Limpopo province. Our goal is to elevate community voices in mining decisions and policy making and to facilitate community managed engagement, sharing and unification around the environmental and socioeconomic impacts of mining host communities. Our vision is to promote the human rights of communities affected by mining and to capacitate, empower, and unite mining affected communities through training and activism to enable them to defend their right to a healthy environment and to benefit from their own land. We are also making these oral submissions against the recently developed narrative that mining is done for the national interest and therefore no single community must be allowed to make decisions on where and how the mining should happen. As Kukuna mining-affected communities, we view this as inappropriate because host communities are the ones who enjoy the brunt of negative impact of mining. Mining undermines our livelihoods in that they are not allowed to decide on their own form of development. And it is simply imposed upon us, and we are forced to adapt ourselves and the plans we had for our communities. The country's Mineral and Petroleum Resource Development Act of 2002, which was brought into effect in 2004, was deeply flawed from the start, excluding mine host communities' input and thus making them second-class citizens in our own backyard. Since then, the changes either implemented or in the pipeline continue to make this MPRDA worse. Reading through both the existing MPRDA and the current bill, you'll only find few lines about the mining communities. Both these documents, instead of talking more about the legitimacy of the mine host communities, they are failing to recognize us as legitimate stakeholders in the mining environment. Taking a trip down memory lane in rural Limpopo province and maybe make a case review on its infrastructure development and the rate of unemployment, you will think maybe mining is there for visit. But in actual fact, the mining has been there for more than 40 decades. For many years, we have always put the blame solely on mining companies. But the truth of the matter lies with the department, if not with the entire government. We, as mining host communities, we suffer significantly from the damaging document that continuously regulates the mining communities while protecting the mining investors at community's expense. Taking a look at the current MPRDA bill, you'll find that it has many flaws which exclude poor mining communities. For example, the bill envisioned the creation of mining advisory council comprising of representatives from the department, labor, and businesses, while mining host communities will have no representative at all. And the bill also states that the government will have an automatic 20% free carry interest in all new exploration and protection rights. And they will also be entitled to a further participation interest in the form of acquisition at an agreed price or in the form of production sharing agreements, and all this will happen at the expense of the poor mine host communities. And it will also make the department a player and a referee at the same time, thus protecting the interest above those of poor communities. The other disturbing factor with the partially drafted MPRDA amendment bill is that it gives the minister the massive powers to invite applications for various available based on information at hand to the minister regarding actual or potential ability of minerals to be extracted or very least prospected for. The bill is actually taking a wrong turn, of which it infringes the rights of mine host communities. One example of this empowering character is the scrubbing of mandatory conditions for community participation in the mining. The department wants the minister to set conditions for mining on community land, but now wishes to delete participation conditions. This is but one example of watering down community recognition in mining sector. And again, the bill in terms of Section 10.2 of the MPRDA says, if a person objects to the granting of prospecting right, mine right, or mining payment, a regional manager must refer the objection to the Regional Mine Development and Environmental Committee so that the validity of the objection can be considered before committee advises the minister on how to proceed. However, no further detail is provided and no indication is given as to what type of objection will be regarded as appropriate valid obligation. And community, again, they don't have a bigger say in the granting of mine license, prospecting rights, and environmental matters. Once more, looking at the social and labor plans. Social and labor plan is the mandatory requirement to obtain the mining license, but it does not weigh the same mass when it comes to implementation and in the process revoking the license. In this case, it should be a matter of law that if the license holder fails to implement the commitment on the SLB, then the license should be revoked. This should not only be done by the powers of the minister. It must also lie with the community. And then again, there's no clear standard guidelines on how the acceptable SLP should look like, and all the powers in this regard lie with the department officials to determine by using the checklist, not the expertise. And again, the mining applications are approved without checking whether the applicant has the resources to implement the SLP commitment. It should be required that the applicant disclose their financial capacity and sources to implement their commitment from the first year of operation. Again, the Act should actually require the department to ensure capacity in the form of inspectors, community interface forums to monitor implementation, not just to rely on the annual report. Basically, as it stands, the DMR relies only on the annual report without actually doing the social audits on whether the social reports are legit or not. They are not doing site visits on the communities in which mining are taking places. And it should be required by law that drafting the social labor plan should include communities. This will ensure that the real and necessary projects are indeed meant to uplift the lives of the communities affected by the mining activities. And again, one of the disturbing factors, the matching of SLP and IDP, the government IDP. I'm suggesting that we are saying the project should not be adopted into the SLP, but rather be taken into account when drafting the social labor plan. The local municipalities should use their own budget to undertake their own project, and the mine should use their own budget to undertake the SLPs, not to integrate the two. Okay. And one of the other things is the consultation process. The MPRDA is a solid piece of legislation compared to other countries, but we have identified quite extensive loopholes and key vulnerabilities like lack of efficient community consultation. Taking, for example, in Limpopo, we only have two consultations in Lewahom and in Venda. And if you look deeply into that, it was hard for people like me from rural mining communities to go to Lewahom and make a presentation. Some of us, it was my first time seeing the MPRDA bill, and I haven't even read through it. Even the wording inside it is not suitable for someone from the mining community. And again, not even our traditional authority in Limpopo is going to, The public participation are often carried out through or with the traditional authorities, excluding the most affected people, which are communities. And if you look, like my colleague mentioned, if you look in this whole country, not even one sentence already in Popo is considered in accordance with to the provision of the National Traditional Authority Framework Act, which then renders this process unlawful. Direct consultation with affected and impacted communities must be required by law. The process of consultation should be inclusive, extensive, and fair. In conclusion, as you can combine mining affected, we are saying the irony is then that despite 20 years of democracy, the people who should benefit from most democratic dispensation are still denied the very core fundamental demand of being able to participate in the process of making laws that directly affect them. These changes reflect also a fundamental failure to recognize mining host communities as legitimate stakeholders in the mining cycle, even where the industry is affecting every aspect of their lives. As we could combine mining affected communities, we are saying this bill should be rejected in its current form and said that the scope of the process of consultation to the mining communities and community-based organizations should be broadened to allow the following: fair and transparent process of consultation, the practice of prior and free and informed consent principle as mentioned. We also recommend Eskukune combined mining committee that the select committee on land and minerals must form a task team that will be compromised by mining host communities, representatives, mine companies, labor, and other government departments such as DWS, DEA, and DMR to do social audits on mining activities and try to find out which parts of the previous MPRDA were not followed and not implemented. Adesh, thank you.
Thank you very much. That gives us some time to interact with the presentation. Then I'm giving over to our honorable members to ask questions of clarity to the presentation. Honorable Nyambi.
I welcome the presentation. It's only one question, Chair, the one that I asked to the first presenter today. Anything that you think is significant that you'll want us to consider when dealing with what you have presented to us that is not part of what you have highlighted as part of your report to us? We do have your presentation. I'm saying you might have something that you think is very important that you have to consider ultimately when dealing with all the presentations when we are consolidating the report that you think will assist us to come to a particular determination that you haven't even presented now. But if you have covered everything, it's fine. I'm just giving you an opportunity for a second bite to share with us any other relevant information that we have to consider.
I think I've covered everything.
Honorable Lebuskachny.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I just want the clarity. You mentioned SLP and IDP and then said the process should not be combined budget. I wrote it in my layman's language, how I understand you say they must not combine the budget. So can you just give me clarity on how you feel they should take into consideration the IDP process of the local municipality and or the province? But when it comes to initiating the services or whatever, the budget should not go through or should not be done by the municipality or the province. The mining company should do that. Just give me clarity on what you said on that point. Thank you.
Sorry, before you respond to it, I wanted to ask that question myself as well, because I'm just thinking aloud when you were presenting on the issue of not integrating the plans of the mines with the municipality. Take, for instance, the issue of water that they use. Municipality had to budget for the water for the mining sector to be able to use, and also the roads and all that. So when you say there should be no integration, what exactly informed you to say that? Thank you.
Thank you. I'll just like to give a practical example of what's happening in my area. There is a municipality and there is a mine. If there's no water, it's hard to put a blame, like currently the situation, we don't have water. But it's hard to, when you say go to the municipality and say we don't have water, they say no. That's part of the mine should do that. And when you go to the mine, they say no. That's part of the municipality's IDP. And then it is hard to say who's wrong because they have interacted the project, the SLP and the IDP, which means the mine doesn't want to spend the money on the SLP regarding water, and the municipality also doesn't want to spend money on water because according to IDP. And it gets difficult from the community to say the mine is wrong or the community is wrong, the municipality is wrong.
Thank you very much. But the fact of the matter, the water authority is the municipality. I think that one had to be very clear. It cannot be made the responsibility of the mine to provide water. That one is very clear. Does that... Yes, ma'am.
Just another clarifying question. The chairperson may use the example of water, for instance. What I need to understand is, if we go along with the example of water, for instance, are you saying that in a community where water, for instance, is a problem, we have a community, and before mining starts or with whatever, there's a problem with water? Okay? So from your presentation, do you say that the fact that there's a problem with water, or say, for instance, a clinic, infrastructure, housing, whatever, roads, infrastructure, whatever it is, people living in that town would say we would like a school, for instance. Some part of the community that's been affected, because municipalities is like very often it's the municipality and some smaller other communities around the municipality. And the community for where the mine is would say, we would like clean water. And then the two priorities of these two communities is actually putting next to each other. Is that the issue? And the budget for that, because the mining would say we will deliver all. For this community, it's important to have the water, and for that community, it's important to have the school, and then you have this whole thing of what is important for different communities. Is that what you? Is that part of this the thinking process or not?
Yes, ma'am.
Given that there are no more hints, let us thank you for your presentation very much. Yes, we do have the copies. Oh, okay. Then it takes us to our next presenter, which is PETA Attorneys.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Where is she? Can you come closer, please?
Must I come closer? Thank you, Chair, members of Parliament's Select Committee on Land and Mineral Resources, colleagues from industry and stakeholders. My name is Dineo Peta. I am an attorney specializing in mining law, and we represent black businesses and communities. I'd like us, just before I go into the details of my presentation, to touch upon the vision for the mining industry as per the Mining Charter of 2004, which is to create a globally competitive mining industry for the benefit of all South Africans. And I think we need to touch upon this in our submissions and bear in mind that what we seek to achieve with this legislation is to have a healthy economy, a healthy industry, but with that advance the transformation objectives and agenda of government. If I can go into the definitions. It is our submission that the definition of historically disadvantaged individual should be repealed and replaced with that of black persons to be aligned with the amendments of the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Act, read with the DTI codes, which were amended in 2013. This would further be in alignment if we consider the amendments of the Mining Charter that were published last week, and we need to seek alignment with these various policies and legislations in terms of the definitions. I'm going to the objectives of the Act. In addressing the historical imbalances of South Africa's past in accordance with this Constitution, it is important to bear in mind the manner in which black people were unlawfully dispossessed of land during apartheid. And in this regard, we ask the question whether it should not be one of the objectives in considering these amendments as to whether, in line with government's objectives of land redistribution, should mineral land also not be considered as part of those that pool of land that we are considering in redistribution. It's just a question I'm posing, not necessarily a submission, but I think it's something that we need to ponder upon, particularly in looking at the current poverty of host communities and those that have been unlawfully dispossessed of land, and in addressing this and remedying the situation. With regard to Section 9 on invitation for applications, the amendments for where the minister will invite applications, it is our submission that there's a potential bias with this proposed amendment, a potential bias to a prospecting right holder that has invested money in prospecting activities who may or may not be invited, as the provision does not clearly stipulate the circumstances under which one may or may not be invited to submit an application. On the amendments to Section 28 pertaining to information in respect of mining rights, it is our submission that Section 28(2)(c) should be amended to consider information from black companies and communities. Currently, as the legislation stands, it only makes provision for information submitted by a mining company. And this now creates a bias, in my opinion, in terms of how we assess this information, because on the one hand, industries of the opinion, or Chamber of Mines, for instance, is of the opinion that there's progress with transformation. However, communities are of the opinion that there isn't transformation. Black businesses are also of the opinion that there isn't transformation. So I think there needs to be an objective assessment, objective consideration and receipt of information, that it not be confined to the information received from mining companies, but there be a holistic assessment of the information. With regard to the amendments to Section 47, which deals with the minister's power to suspend, cancel rights, permits, or permissions, it is our submission that the minister should invoke the provisions of Section 47 where there is found to be non-compliance with the approved social and labor plan or with the mining charter. The proposed amendments propose a revision of the social and labor plan every 5 years. And our submission is that if if it transpires that on every year of assessment, a particular mining company is found to be non-compliant, the minister should, after that period of assessment, invoke the provisions of Section 47 to enforce compliance and either suspend or cancel the right, obviously allowing the holder of the right to remedy the situation of their non-compliance. With regard to Section 98, dealing with offences and penalties, Chair, it is our submission that non-compliance to the Social and Labour Plan and to the Mining Charter must be regulated as a specific offence in terms of the MPRDA and also penalised in terms of Section 99. We continue to have circumstances and situations and incidents of fronting, of marginalisation of black businesses, disregard for community concerns, but there are no penalties. There isn't an enactment of penalties to address this. And we feel that this should be regulated within the framework of Section 98. Chair, we can sit here and, you know, speak, amend legislation but in the absence of proper monitoring and implementation, we will not achieve much in terms of implementing specifically the transformation objectives. Regulation 46 of the MPRDA deals specifically with the SRP and the content thereof and what the Department of Mineral Resources is supposed to audit. However, there are inconsistencies in preparing for my presentation, and as I prepared to write an article on the Mining Charter, I decided to take out the Mining Charter Impact Assessment Report of 2015, and I compared that to the Employment Equity Report of 2015-2016. And the Impact Assessment Report, as an example, reflects white males to be at 37.4% in top management. However, the Employment Equity Report records white males to sit at 59.9%. And this is a serious discrepancy in my opinion, because one is saying, and as industry is arguing, there's compliance to the objectives of transformation. However, if we look at the Employment Equity Report, there is clearly very little progress as to achieving the transformation objectives. And in this regard, we feel that it's prudent that the DMR allocate far more resources to monitoring and implementation and to capacitate itself, whether internally or externally, with the correct or extensive resources, particularly if we now consider the targets that were set by the Mining Charter last week that was gazetted. There's a very short time frame for implementation, and if that is not properly implemented, then it does not really serve a purpose. And as such, it is our further submission that perhaps the DMR should appoint a committee that is specifically tasked to deal with matters of non-compliance and enforcement. In closing, the industry, together with the agriculture and mining, were the only two industries that have shown economic recovery or healthy growth in the past two quarters. And in this regard, and slightly with reference to the Mining Charter gazetted last week, is that, you know, as much as we seek to achieve transformation, and it's an imperative, it's a must, it's long overdue that transformation be, in my opinion, a radical. However, in seeking to achieve this radical approach, we need to balance and ensure that we're not crippling the industry with onerous obligations, particularly those obligations that have financial implications, and there be a sort of a proper, yes, though radical, but a proper transition into what we seek to achieve. And in this regard, we call upon government to be reasonable and practical in terms of the amendments that they seek to legislate. However, this necessitates a collaborative approach from all stakeholders involved, because industry as well cannot continue to treat transformation as a tick box or as an act of charity for black people when it is a legislative imperative. We need to combine our respective objectives and seek to find a collaborative approach that will support industry and at the same time support the objectives that we seek to advance in terms of our legislation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Now I will allow members of the committee to ask questions. It looks like it's quite straightforward. No questions. Thank you very much, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair.
Let me explain first that the Offshore Petroleum Association of South Africa, they have apologized. They are unable to come today. So based on that apology, we have decided to take Black First and Land First because they were around Cape Town and they were asking if they cannot come today, and we have said they should. Now we'll give it to Black First, Land First to come and present. Because you were not here when we started the meeting, you just joined us. I would like just to explain the process that each organization or a member of the public will only give 30 minutes to present and as well to ask questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Israel yetu, Africa yetu. Chair, thanks for the opportunity and the committee for Black First, Land First to make this submission. We, of course, were provided the opportunity next week, but for the reasons you stated, we are happy to do it now. But before we proceed, Chair, there is a consent that must be registered. That when we walked in here, we were quickly accompanied by a lot of security men who are known as white shirts, and they are in their house. In fact, I saw that one of them switched off the light at some point, I suppose, rehearsing whatever that they need to do. So we are not here as a matter of favor. The constitution of this country provides for people like ourselves to come before Parliament. So why do we have these security men? Who send them here? And why must we continue under these circumstances of heavy security presence? We're not criminals, we're revolutionaries. So, Chair, unless there's a proper explanation, we'll ask that these men leave this room right away. Thank you.
We didn't see any security inside the room. Honorable Mlambo and Honorable Nyambi.
Honorable Chair, thank you very much. There have been a number of presentations this morning. that were taking place. So I don't think we need to have a problem. You'll identify it as a chair and rule on it if really there is a problem. But we have received a number of presentations and the house has been full like it is now. So can I suggest that we proceed? Let them present, and if they are being disturbed by whoever, then we'll rule on that as a chair. Thank you.
Honorable Nyambi.
Partly covered, Chair, but the other thing that I wanted to add is that not unless they can indicate that any of them that was supposed to be part of the presenters was held by the people that we don't know. But if that is not the case, then I second that let's continue and let them be assured that there won't be any disturbances. We're going to be very objective and do justice to the presentation.
That's a view of the members of the committee. That let's allow you, I also agree with them, let's allow you to make your presentation. But if any of your members get some problems in terms of the people that you've referred to, we will deal with the matter immediately. Can we then allow you to present?
No, Chair, I want to put it on the record that they are men. These members of, honorable members, can't see them. Did not see these men coming with us. They were not here before anyone else. They accompanied us from, in fact, when we walked into Parliament. And we inquired, we're told these are the people who beat other people here in Parliament. So let us not pretend that in this particular room at this point, we have a lot of security men who are hostile and who we have seen, you yourself have seen, honorable member. They're practicing how to shut down this lighting system in this room. You saw that. You sit here now and pretend that you have not seen these men coming here security. So I want to put it on record that this parliament and this committee and some honorable members seem to have called in security specifically for PLF to be on this house. So you are not the one who are being policed. We are the ones who are being policed. We are the ones who are raising concern, and you are the ones who are failing to protect us. We want to put that on record.
Thank you very much. I am sure it is quite recorded. My apologies on the feeling of the organization, but I'm worried your time is getting up of your presentation. But we assure you are safe in this room.
No, we are not safe.
No one will touch you. You will finish your presentation with no hiccups at all. Can you please present?
No, Chair, we are not safe. We don't feel safe, and we are making that point. You should be telling these men to leave this room now. Anyway, our organization is called Black First, Land First, and it's a Pan-Africanist and a Black Consciousness Revolutionary Organization, and we're also registered with the Independent Electoral Commission. We hold, as BLF, the view that the central contradiction in South Africa is one of white supremacy, and this problem was created with the arrival of settlers in 1652 and those who stole our land and enslaved us. This is the central contradiction that organizes any other contradictions, including that what we are going to talk about now. In the economic sector or sphere, this contradiction manifests in what we call white monopoly capital. That is a key question, the land question and white supremacy. Now, there is no possibility that we can talk about the transformation of the minerals and the petroleum sector without addressing the land question. It is for this reason, if you have our presentation and you were to look at point four, that the call for land expropriation without compensation by the president of the country, President Zuma, it's a critically important step in the right direction. And this committee has to adopt this as a primary principle in terms of the bill, land expropriation without compensation. If you don't do that, and I think the previous presenter, the legal person, made this point, linking the resolution of the minerals and the petroleum questions to the land question. the 9.5. So the committee must support President Zuma. Only agents of imperialism and white monopoly capital will have a problem with that. And we are arguing in point 5 that all the land in South Africa, in which is in white hands today, was stolen from black people. Therefore, all white people who hold land, including, in this case, the mines, are in possession of stolen property. This stolen land includes all of its endowments, whether it be on surface, together with the fortunes underground, as well as the skies and the oceans. Chair, we just want to say we are here with comrades of our movement, from Khayelitsha mostly, and in Khayelitsha as we speak. Our people there are landless and are fighting for land. In fact, one of the leaders of the land struggle in Khayelitsha was murdered by what we believe to be the police. You need to know, as parliamentarians, we are serious about representing the interests of our people. We buried these comrades 2 weeks ago here in Khayelitsha, fighting just for a piece of land to call home. Now, this committee and the bill is making big claims about what must happen to minerals. But our people, as we speak, are under attack, and they're being murdered by the same settlers who still have our land. And I'm glad to see that that man of Groenewald, this so-called Honorable Groenewald, is not in the house, because that man has declared war on black people, and he said there's going to be a civil war. I'm very happy to see Chase not in this room here, because he's one of those people that we must throw out. He must not speak in the presence of black people. We are suggesting the following in terms of this bill before this house. That as an important principle, we must talk about nationalization of the minerals and natural resources so that we can get to ownership. And quickly now, Chair, I will go through some of the minimums that in that process must be realized if black people are going to benefit. And you will see, Chair, that our categories are not out of variance with the mining charter, but our percentages of ownership are slightly higher than what the mining charter provides. For instance, if you go to point 11, just go point 11A, where we talk about community share ownership schemes, we as BLF say that to counter the culture of patronizing corporate social responsibility concessionary programs that has traditionally characterized the big mining sector, we are saying that we need a secured for community a proportion of at least 20% of equity in the mining businesses. It is not a favor. You know, mining houses, these colonial constructs, these racist, violent monsters, think that they are doing a favor to our people, promising to build houses which they never do, providing social amenities which they never do. They are just here to steal and plunder. Now we say ownership of our people, and we say 20% of ownership in the area where the mining house is. And that is why I want to employ the communities of Sekhukhune, that we must support the mining charter so that we press for direct ownership. And then I'll quickly move to also, if you go to the second page 3, we want a worker and state ownership. And quickly to simply say, also for us, is workers must own 20% instead of the 8% which has been provided for by the mining charter. Also, black business must own that 14% provided for. And then if you were to go down to D2, I just want to highlight there that at the level of procurement, we agree with the mining charter that at least 70% of goods procured in the mining sector must be legislated in terms of this bill, that they must must come from black people. In E, we are calling for a national sovereign wealth development fund, which basically all nations that have mineral resources have this, which is really a state or the national wealth, how it is organized. And this will help those of us who are not in the mining sector, who are not workers or who are not entrepreneurs. Ordinary South Africans must get a dividend from the minerals. South Africa has the highest deposits of minerals known on Earth. at the end of a financial year, ordinary South Africans, after we pay for schools, for healthcare and all that, we must get a dividend in cash. That must come into our pockets. And black people must get first. If there's anything left, we'll see what to do with white people. Because this is reparations. White people have benefited for 350 years. They can't benefit now. We must deal with those who have been excluded first, and then whites, if we so feel, we might do something about that. Now, I will jump these provisions that we make in the interest of time in page on the strategic objective. You will read that yourself.
Okay.
But I do want to talk about the penal provisions. You know, even the presentation before us did indicate there's a problem of non-compliance, and where the law says certain things must happen, they never happen. We are saying that instead of the penalties which are suggested by the bill, which in summary would be the fine of 5 million rand or 5 years in terms of a 5 years term of imprisonment, and also that fine of 100,000 or 2 years, we reject this. This must be changed, and the way it must be changed, we say that it must move to penalties must equate to 50% of the annual turnover of the year of transgression, and this is lenient. We should be saying 100% turnover of that year of transgression, but we are lenient. We're allowing these criminals some breathing space. And then we're saying that those who are found guilty should serve a minimum of 10 years in jail. And then this bill must strengthen its monitoring and non-compliance mechanism because they are very weak. Now, Chair, I want to turn to a matter which we believe the bill is silent on, and that is what is called the Zamazamas. The amendment or the bill is silence on the Zamazamas. These are the real miners and owners of the land. BLF calls for the legal recognition of the artisanal or small-scale miners known as Zamazamas. These, as we say, are the real owners of the minerals in our country. They are not a foreign force here to exploit and murder, like Lonmin that killed our people in Marikana, with the assistance of the current deputy president of the country, Cyril Ramaphosa. He's the one who called the police, and they murdered our people there in Marikana. We buried people in Marikana in defense of a foreign force called Lonmin. And Lonmin, this is a shocking thing, Che. You know, let's just deal with this. Oak Bay, the so-called Gupta company, their accounts have been shut down by the banks. Lonmin, a confirmed known mass murdering company, is running its business with no problems in this country. These opposition parties that claim to fight for economic freedom, they have not called for Lonmin to leave this country. But they are jumping up and down and saying the Guptas must go or President Zuma must go. But here, they're murderers. I hear, and they're doing business. We're saying that must change. The Zamazamas are the real owners of these minerals. We say we are clear that these white-owned mines continue to terrorize our people and even murder them. If you go to Kimberley today, our comrades have been killed by these mining houses. BLF advises that the bill incorporate a provision for the formal recognition of the Zamazama miners. So you must decriminalize them. There must be a clear provision for decriminalization of these artisanal miners. Also that the state and the mining houses, by law, must be tasked with ensuring the safety of the Zamazama miners. We don't have the time now, but if you think about it, mostly when there is this is safety questions, is because these criminal white-owned mining houses have come into our communities, they have mined, they took all our minerals, and they leave these mines as holes where our people are left with hunger and they end up going to mine them. So the responsibility of safety of when our people, these so-called Zamazamas, must lie with the mines and the state. And then a very important proposal we're making is that the state or government be the official buyer of the Zama Zama product. You see, Honorable Chair, Chair and members, those who are honorable amongst you, the question of how Zama Zamas actually go down the mines, and some in Kimberley is more open crust. They get these minerals, whether it's diamonds, whether it's gold. You know who actually buys from them? We have no capacity to buy. It is white monopoly capital. It is Johann Rupert and the Oppenheimers who benefit directly from the Zama Zamas after having made them illegal and attacking them when they actually go and mine. So let us resolve this issue. The state must say, Zama Zama, go get your diamonds, go get your gold, bring it to the state. We'll buy at a good price. In this way, we'll actually deal even with criminality. Because you're not driving black mining underground. You bring it on the surface, you provide a good price for our people, you provide a security, and our people will not also fight amongst themselves the way it is. We have criminalized our people and creating the conditions that are there when our people fighting in these areas. We're saying they are Zama Zama miners. No, Zama Zama miners are the owners of the land and the mines. And therefore, this committee, if it's serious about providing support for black people, we suggest you do this and you buy from the Zama Zamas. We also ask that this bill should include a provision for freeing all the currently arrested Zama Zamas. A lot of our people called Zama Zamas are in jail as I speak to you. Lots of them. They are arrested for mining our own land. In the communities in Limpopo, we go there. The police are busy arresting our people instead of arresting white monopoly capital, which are the real criminals. People must pay bail. People are... So, now, let me turn to the mining charter. There was a white man who spoke here before the Sikukuni community spoke. He demonized the mining charter, just like all the white monopoly capital. We want this committee to recognize, and it will be good, Chair, to acknowledge Minister Zwane, Msebenzi Zwane, as a revolutionary, visionary minister who correctly interprets what is meant by radical economic transformation as provided for by the president of the country in the SONA. That is why we are saying everybody must support this charter now, even when we have some questions about it. But we must support, because remember, for 23 years, we have not been able to benefit anything. Here comes a Minister Zwane and says, in 12 months, we must achieve the 30% black ownership. That is revolutionary. That is visionary. That is good for all of us. We are not even going to talk about all these other provisions because of time of the charter itself. But then, what does it mean in terms of the bill before you, this charter? Because the charter comes now, long after the bill, we've been engaging with it. All we are suggesting is that this committee aligns the bill with the provisions of the charter. Make them legal. Don't listen to that white man who's a beneficiary of theft, who's saying that the minister is trying to use executive to impose. No, but we are here in parliament today. We are saying you, parliament, use the parliamentary systems to regularize and make sure that the provisions of the charter are as the law provides. What is wrong with that? You know, white arrogance also make white people ignorant. This is a real problem. So we are standing before you and saying, committee, let us align the bill with the provision of the charter. And I'm not going to go through those, but are beautiful provisions, the 30%, the 8% employees share, the 8% mining community share, the 14% black entrepreneurs share. We support that, including our own moves that we have indicated earlier. So we support this as a transitional mechanism. Once we have the 30% and the 8% here, we then consolidate and then move to the next layer of demands. We will leave all that and then come to, Chair, an important point that I invite you now to go to the last page, which is page 8. Here we now deal with the transformation of the banking system. Chair, It is not going to help us to have a very good bill and legislation that provides for black people to benefit in the minerals of this country if the financial sector itself remains a cartel run by a white few families such as the Rupert's. They're shutting down bank accounts. They're criminalizing us at will. They are refusing to support the black bank processes. And we said we want to get a dividend. If these whites, these white monopoly capitalists, or control the banking system, how is that money coming to come to our banks, I mean to our pockets? Because we know they shut down banks of those they hate. And ourselves as a revolutionary movement, which supports the fact that land belongs to black people and we must be black first, we are also knowing we're meeting hostility in the banking sector already as I speak to you. So what are we going to do, Chair, and the Honorable Committee, or that part of the committee is honorable, is that we need to reform the mining sector, or rather, let me read this. The important reforms of the mining sector are going to be sabotaged by the colonial, racist, and corrupt banking sector. I hope you all know that the Commission has just come, the Competition Commission has just come out with a determination that more than 17 banks are involved in corruption. We also know in 2015, those banks, when President Zuma wanted to appoint a proper minister, not a captured minister such as Pravin and Santanene, the banks, took away 500 billion in 3 days of the JSE. We know that. So, and the Competition Commission has also confirmed this. Furthermore, our public protector just yesterday has released the report that shows that Absa is a rogue bank. It's a criminal bank.
Yeah.
Now, these provisions on the banking system are not directly, we are clear, are not directly related to what you are doing here, but Chair, surely in the interest of governance, which is interrelated, we can send this message over to the minister responsible, or the committees responsible. And of course the ruling party is the same ruling party that sits in the other committees. Now we are saying that...
Sorry, just a minute. You are left with 5 minutes.
Okay, I will then...
And my worry is that you're no longer talking on the bill, but I felt I must give you some time, but now you're left with 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. No problem. That white man spoke, and then you gave him further 5 minutes, so I've got more. I've got another 5 minutes.
Order, Mr. Ngutam. Let's do things accordingly. For instance, it's not correct for you to debate the presentation of another stakeholder. You're supposed to be sticking on your own.
Thank you, Chair.
10 minutes to myself.
Thank you, Chair. In the definition of debate, it's never restricted to, but let's leave that. So we are saying here, the banking sector, the cartel must be broken, and a clear message must be sent that for in the interest of holistic radical economic transformation and the necessity to act in tandem with, in particular, Treasury, it must be impressed upon the Minister of Minerals, Malusi Gigaba, that his reluctance to move with great speed to licensing a black bank and state bank is an act of self-sabotage. If we are not going to have a black bank and a state bank soon, like in 12 months, we must forget about this. Because white monopoly capital is going to close down. Treasury must be employed to immediately fully license banks that are black or state-owned, and we list some of them here, such as the VBS, such as the Post Bank, and also a black bank. It must come into line. This must happen immediately, or blacks are going to be in perpetual mercy to banks such as Absa. In fact, we are clear that Absa itself, the state must immediately withdraw all its accounts with Absa. And these monies, which are lots of monies, can then be used to support the emergence of a black bank and a state bank, which will then be able to support our communities and our people as we take the minerals back to our people. The hegemony of Johann Rupert in the banking sector must end. And it's only the bravery of you as a committee, with us, the people, that can ensure that. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can I then ask the members of the committee to ask questions? I see the hand of Honorable Nyambi.
Thanks, Chair. Two questions. The first one is about the Zama Zama. As a committee, when we'll be dealing with it, maybe my interest is to understand how is it going to be done, because, like, I'm from Mpumalanga, and Zama Zama people, they don't just do it in Mpumalanga. If you'll find somebody from Mpumalanga doing it in Gauteng or Limpopo, and only to find that the community in that particular area would be revolting, saying, no, let it be somebody who's doing Zama Zama, who's from Sekhukhune, instead of having somebody coming from Gauteng. So I miss that part, how it's going to be done, because it's not people that are residing in their municipalities. The second one is about the process we're involved in. As we are aware that the bill was referred back by the president, and we are the house that represented the interests of provinces. So out of interest sake, are we going to be getting the same presentation, because there will be public participation at provincial level in all the 9 provinces, or the one that is being presented by the national structure is going to be different to the one that will be done by the province? But it's out of interest sake, so that we can understand, and it will really make our life to be much more easier when doing the consolidation ultimately at the end. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. No other hand, you can respond.
Okay, thanks, Chair. No, see, if we regularize the Zama Zamas, it will actually assist in making sure that duplication and the actual domicile of the Zama Zama is clarified. Of course, our attitude as a Pan-Africanist organization is not to say you are from Mpumalanga, or you're from Zimbabwe, or you are from Nigeria. If you are in the bank, in the mining sector, you have an equal right, because the exploitation of our people by the mining sector, you know, it went to Africa-wide. So every black person who engages in the process of independent mining, which is this, what you call Zama Zama, should be registered, supported, and in this way, I will not necessarily be mining in Mpumalanga and in another place, because we'll be in the register. Or unless there's a justification for why I should be mining in different areas. By the way, Anglo-American mines everywhere in this country. So that objection is not sustainable, in fact. Unless we say to Anglo-American also, you can only mine in one place. So let us allow our people to mine, use their energies and the communities. What kind of a community is that which is not supporting the Zama Zamas, who are mining in its own backyard? The first people must be that community that organizes with the Zama Zamas. We are not enemies. We are the same people. So our advice to the community is, you cannot uhlale khoneni ukangukuthi uzosizakala. Join the Zama Zamas, protect the Zama Zama, be a Zama Zama yourself. And in this way, we can resolve this issue. In terms of your second question, indeed, this is a national a presentation, but you will see when you come to the provinces, we'll tailor it to deal. Of course, the framework will be the same, but there are specificities. Like if you go to the Northern Cape, there's a specific problem there, which is different from the problem of Limpopo, for instance, where people are facing serious evictions, but the arresting of people in a different types of minerals give us a different texture. So you will hear us in the provinces, but we will be emphasizing the actual experiences per province. Here, for instance, we should be talking about Perlemoon. You know Perlemoon, Abelon. That is our thing, that thing. It's the black people's property. These white people who are having licenses must be revoked. They must not be. That Abalon is ours, and we are not benefiting from it. And that is an issue for this province. But we are saying we will make those emphasis as you move in the different provinces.
Is that a follow-up, Honorable Yembe? Okay.
No. I was covered. I never wanted to raise it earlier on, because it was going to divert him and deal with what I want to raise now. I'll be failing as a member of parliament if I'm not raising it. To PLF, maybe in the future, if you are coming to parliament, for us to be able to focus on the substantive nature of your presentation instead of other issues that are sideways. It will really assist us to avoid creating unnecessary confrontation, like when you refer to us that if you are honorable, it means we are implying that we are not honorable, and that is not correct, and that is not the essence of your presentation. But if you come in, respect us, we respect you, we focus on the presentation, we shake hands, we leave, and then that's it. But the fight sometimes is not necessary. So it's a brotherly advice from an honorable member of this house.
Thank you, Honorable Nyambi. Maybe a part of addition so that when you respond to it, you respond to all of them. Also, as from the chair, I'll be failing the house if I do not protect the organizations that were here to come and present, to be labeled because of their color. It's unfortunate that I'm from the organization that believes on non-racialism. So if in this house we promote that white people should be called names in meetings that are chaired by us, it would be not correct, because we stay with them, we work with them, they are part of South Africans. I think that one, I must also raise it very sharply. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. And the Honorable, honor is not declared, but must say properly be earned. You know, I do not say this with the attempt to minimize. If you feel honorable, then you must be honorable. Don't worry. The only the dishonorable must feel that this affects them. Honorable blacks must not feel injured. But how are you honorable when you are landless in your own country also? It's a question. It's just a question. Landless people can never be honorable because they are tenants in their own land. We live under the condition of general dishonor in our own land. We're a black majority. We call each other honorables, occasionally insult each other when all of us are landless. It is a matter that I think we must think about, all of us as black people. That is why we support President Zuma when he says land expropriation without compensation. And some of the not-so-honorable members are shaking on this question. Now, Chair, non-racialism cannot mean we can't say white people are white and white people stole our land. Non-racialism, if it means we must lie, then it is a dishonorable proposition. The man who spoke here and rubbished the mining charter is a white man who benefited from colonialism. It is not a disputed fact. 1652, white people arrived here. They stole our land. They enslaved us. Today, white people have more than 80% of our land. We are landless. In Khayelitsha today, our comrades have been murdered just for a piece of land to call a home. I am not ashamed. All the land is in your hands. The black majority don't have land. We don't even have land to bury our own. Do you know that? So, no. If non-racialism is a denial of a historical fact, and the fact that 23 years later, we have the vote, those people still have the land. No, a honorable member. That is not very honorable. Let us correct that matter so that we can be properly honorable people working proudly in our country, knowing that the land and the minerals belongs to us.
Thank you very much. We really thank you for your presentation. Although you deviated a lot, we accept that because we invited you. And my apologies to those that have been called names on behalf of the committee. Thank you. Now we'll be going to our next, which is Bahlokwane Bamanzimanyana. Ne? Thank you. Let me explain to the 11:30 to 12 o'clock Chamber of Mines. They were unavailable for today. Now we're going to the next one. My apologies for that.
My name is John Mukwena from Bahlakwana Bamanzimnyama. Yes, and I also have Thandoluhle Mankge, who's also our member. I am today representing Bahlakwana Bamanzimnyama as a trustee of Bahlakwana Bamanzimnyama Communal Land Trust. The purpose of our presentation today is to thank Parliament for allowing us to address it, to submit our comments to the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Amendment Bill, to highlight the impact of mining legislation on affected communities on the ground, to request Parliament to stop the continuation of white monopoly capital in mining, to recommend radical economic transformation in the mining industry. Bahlakwana Bamanzimnyama is a clan that lost its land and livestock in the Emalahleni area in Mpumalanga. This happened through systematic reduction of our grandfather's land until the clan was pushed out of the land completely. Our grandfather, with many head of cattle, also conducted subsistence mining of coal, was removed from his land to allow Anglo-American to commercially mine the land without any compensation or restitution. Instead, our grandmother was exhumed and reburied from one part of the farm to the high-density black township of Kwakuka, destroying part of our history. We are now poor and destitute because we are denied our birthright of generational wealth inheritance. Bahlakwana Bamanzimnyama participated in the reopening of the land claim process through Parliament, and we have formally lodged and have an accepted land claim. We also participated in the amendment of the expropriation bill. We would like to thank Parliament and the relevant portfolio committees for allowing us to be part of these processes. Background continued. We started negotiations with Anglo-American in order to start benefiting from the commercial mining operations that are taking place in the land that we have claimed, with no success. We registered as interested and affected parties in 2009 on a project called Rogers Ring on the same land. Anglo-American mined the coal without us benefiting a cent from that project. This project took over about 8 months, but a lot of tonnage went out of that particular piece of land, tonnage of coal. We registered again as interested and affected parties in 2015 for the current Hope Shaft project, expected to take 19 years. Our negotiations thus far are going nowhere. Last year, same time, last year, June 16, Anglo-American requested the community during a formal meeting facilitated by the Department of Mineral Resources the National Department, for us to register any interest in this project I'm talking about, the Hope Shaft project. We sent them the requested letter as per the resolutions taken in the meeting. To date, we did not receive any response or a letter of acknowledgement. We requested the National Department of Mineral Resources to call another meeting this year, which took place last month. Anglo-American claimed that they have not received our registration of interest. We know for the fact that they did receive the letter. They are now changing, telling us that they receive hundreds and hundreds of proposals on a daily basis. And for us, we feel that they are negotiating in bad faith, because we had senior executives coming to a formal meeting with also senior executives from DMR, with us, with minutes taken, with the registers being signed, and we sent the letter to specific people, including their PAs. But they say they receive a number of proposals daily, and they haven't looked at our proposal. They are now claiming that we do not have the capacity to mine, and that is the only reason why they will not consider us for beneficiation. WMC is white monopoly capital in mining. Anglo-American has been mining coal in our area for about 5 decades. There is no empowerment or beneficiation to the local affected community that has happened during this period. This multinational company is continuing to dominate mining in this area because it owns most of our land and mining rights granted long before 1994. And we believe that this is monopolizing the industry, because before 1994, we saw that a lot of mining rights or mining license or permits were granted to Anglo-American. We don't know why the acceleration of the granting of these rights before 1994. I can only make a perception that it was because maybe a black government was coming. That is still has to be investigated. Anglo-American always complies with the mining charter. I'm talking about the second version now, because only a few select triple BEEs sitting in Joburg always get the deals, while the real affected communities on the ground get nothing. We feel this is malicious compliance, because they told us straight in our face that they have complied. And they're actually telling the truth. They have complied with legislation, because the 26% at the time was complied with, but we did not get a cent out of that. So the approval of mining permits continue to go to Anglo-American, and this has now become a norm and mainstay. Affected communities are only used for consultation, the box-ticking exercise that we always talk about. And approval of mining licenses, but empowerment goes elsewhere. I'm also going to say this one with a tongue-in-cheek, that many other smaller white companies, we say this not in a negative sense, but to say many other smaller white companies have been granted prospecting rights without our knowledge. And this is increasing. And I think the reason why these prospecting rights are approved is because of our land claim. I think there's a fear that once we get the land back, it will be difficult at that time to get a approval for prospecting. So a lot of them are approved. And these applications and approval thereof for prospecting rights are not advertised in the local media. only on the glass door of the regional office. So the notices are placed there. I went to that office for the first time 2 months ago. That office is not in the CBD of Emalahleni. It's at a shopping mall. It's so hidden, that office. It's under a parking lot, and it's right at the back. It's not lit. It's very dark. And since 2015, I've been trying to get hold of the regional manager, and I couldn't. You call the office, you then get responses. I even was able to get hold of the regional manager of Limpopo, who gave me the email address of the personal assistant. And they were responsive, but our own regional manager in Mpumalanga is not responsive, and we feel that that office is not accessible. So we became aware of these notices and approvals accidentally when we visited the regional office for the first time to access records through the Promotion of Access to Information Act. And it's been 2 weeks now. We have requested, we paid 35 rands to get access to records to check if there are prospecting rights that have been approved on the land that we have claimed. And we have not received the feedbacks so far. So there's a lot of lack of awareness campaigns, training and skills transfer, which results in only white companies continuing to dominate this industry. And we feel that there must be a moratorium placed on all the prospecting rights applications or even approvals on the land that was claimed. With this, we feel that if the regional manager is going to be the chairperson of the regional mining development and environmental committee, as proposed in the new act or in the amendment bill, really we feel the regional managers have too much power and they do as they wish. We also had a number of meetings where the regional manager didn't attend, with DMR, DEA, and also Anglo-American. So as a statement, we say white people benefited from property rights that are now entrenched in the Constitution. They now benefit from mineral rights, which is assisting the entrenching of the white monopoly capital. So basically, white monopoly capital resides within a rich minority, white community. And then you have the black monopoly capital, which is your triple BEEs. It resides within a poor majority black community. So we feel that this status quo is going to remain, because the white monopoly capital uses the black monopoly capital to comply, and then it's a vicious cycle. The black monopoly capital doesn't grow. Radical economic transformation in mining. Here we request that the new act or the minister must be given extensive powers in order to make it difficult for foreign companies, multinationals, local white monopoly capital to get mining licenses without benefiting the local affected communities. Seeing that the mining rights resides within the state, we request the state to donate these rights, these mining rights, to affected communities to effect radical economic transformation. With communities owning mineral rights, this will ensure that they negotiate from a stronger position when they enter into joint venture partnerships with established mining companies. What is happening currently, I don't know, rightfully so, the mining companies like Anglo-American do not take us seriously, because we don't have something ourselves to put on the table. In conclusion, we believe that the land restitution process and the expropriation legislation being developed and granting mineral rights to organized affected communities will pave a way for the true economic emancipation of the previously dispossessed masses. Bahlakwane ba Manzimnyama submitted a letter to DMR in 2015 requesting assistance to obtain mineral rights on the land that we have claimed. We request the minister to follow up on our request and donate those mineral rights to us. Using Bahlakwane ba Manzimnyama as a pilot project will prove that the radical economic transformation is real and not just another rhetoric. We welcome the gazetting of the third version of the mining charter as a right step towards the right direction. We also thank the support of the National Department of Mineral Resources thus far in our ongoing negotiations with Anglo-American. And I think that this mining charter will give us guidelines, especially the 8% for the affected mining communities. I think if we start there and see how it goes, because it talks to the existing rights of the mining houses. But with the new rights, we feel that as an affected community, if those rights, those new rights, can be donated to us, the minister must be given extensive powers to be able to have authority to donate certain mineral rights, looking at the special circumstances of specific communities such as us. I thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Can we then take questions of clarity from the presentation? Honorable Labuskagne.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I just need to some clarity. You said that the existing mining companies using BBBE companies to comply, and in that way the cycle of wealth stays within these same companies. The question of clarity is, can you just give us a clear indication of what is your proposals on how to change the cycle?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Thank you, Honourable Member. I think when we drafted this presentation, we didn't update it. You see, the gazetting of the mining charter last Thursday, we feel now that it is more clearer. The previous second version mining charter was not clear on the 26%. And all that 26% went to a certain select well-established triple BEEs. But now the third version is talking about 30%, and there's a clear breakdown that says 14% can go to those triple BEEs entrepreneurs, and then 8% to the workers in the mine. And the 8% goes to the affected mining communities. To us, I think that is clearer, and if it is really implemented and it is monitored and it is enforced, I think we are going to be covered, and that will break that cycle we feel is disadvantaging us. So basically what we are saying is that if the regional office of Mpumalanga can be monitored from the national office, and ensure that when we submit an application, obviously each and every applicant application must be looked into in its own merit. You know, looking at the governance structures, looking at the special circumstances, and then an approval can be made. So I think monitoring and evaluation and enforcement of that 8%. Must be watched very closely.
Let us thank you, but I must say we have noted a number of points that you have raised under your efforts of negotiating with the company, mining company. And I am happy that you said the department is of good help in terms of your own negotiations. But I'm sure they have also noted some of the challenges that we are facing, so that you can be able, are able to get a proper support in terms of those things that you've raised. Thank you very much for the presentation. That be the last organization to present. It then says this is our last presentation, therefore the meeting of the public hearings is therefore closed. Thank you. I must commend ourselves. It's 12:30 on the dot. We were good in terms of keeping time.